Yeah, it was up against some insane entries. I was like, you know, up against the Sidemen, Jamila Jamil.
No way, that is amazing.
Yeah, we beat them. I think I was up against them locked in as well. Yeah. But yeah,
I'm very proud of you as a friend. So.
Thank you.
For my next guest, we have Welsh presenter and journalist, Mairead Perry. You may know her from presenting her own show, Tea Show Fork.
Mairead, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I've known you quite a long time now, I would say.
Yeah.
So you were a bit predominantly a journalist when I first met you. Mm-hmm. I think maybe you're working for OK.
It must have been, yeah. I think it was about 3 years ago. I thought about this before I came on here.
Oh, really?
And I was like, how long have we known each other? It must be about three and a half years.
So it was through my last PR, and essentially you would interview my talent.
Yeah.
And that was when we were quite small, so it was pretty much Love Island.
I think it was just you and Ella, was it? At that point, it was... I remember Ella and Joe. Yeah, I think I remember meeting you and Ella for the first time outside this castle somewhere in central London. There was a big grand building next to us, and we just drank loads of wine, which sounds like the way you met a lot of people, to be honest.
And I would like to say that is a vicious lie, but it's probably not. I think wine is a real icebreaker.
It is.
And everyone's getting a bit sober at the moment, which is lovely to see. But I just, you know, I love the idea. Mm-hmm. It's just probably not for me.
Yes.
But you've had a complete 180 of your career, really. Because although you were a journalist, you have now become a presenter.
Yeah.
And you're doing bloody well at it.
Well, I'm trying. I'm doing a little bit of everything and trying to be good at everything and not having a day off. But I enjoy it that way. Like, I like working hard. So it's just being good at everything just makes me happy. And I need to keep it up.
Because that's quite a hard pressure you're putting yourself. You can't be good at everything.
Yeah, but it stresses me out. I feel like since I was little, I've always had that in the back of my head. My parents' life, if you don't do something well, don't do it at all. Because like they didn't have much of a career that left the hometown. So they were like, you need to do well.
Well, let's throw it back. Little baby Mairead in Wales. So you are Welsh.
Yeah.
Just in case people weren't aware.
Very proudly Welsh.
Very proudly Welsh. You speak Welsh as well. Yeah. What town were you from?
So I'm from a place called Festiniog, which is...
Festiniog.
Festiniog, yeah, you nailed it.
Thank you.
Pretty much in the arse end of nowhere, no phone reception, about 40-minute drive to a McDonald's.
40 minutes for a McDonald's?
Yeah, an hour drive to a cinema, hour drive to any sort of clothing shop, like really in the middle of nowhere, like surrounded by farms. My family are farmers, so like very rural.
Wow.
Yeah, like as in my school was like the least diverse school you could ever imagine.
Jesus. So was Welsh was taught in your village?
Yeah.
Was that the predominant language?
Yeah. So we were taught English.
So you weren't actually, your first language is Welsh?
Yeah. First language, Welsh. Speak all my family, all my friends from home. And then we were taught English in school. So there was like English lessons, and that's the only class we were allowed to speak in English. So I would learn history through Welsh, learn art through Welsh, maths in Welsh, and you weren't allowed to speak English. Yeah.
Oh.
Like, you mean you could, but like you'd be reprimanded for it.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But this is a Welsh school, you speak Welsh. I think they're just trying to preserve the language. So they were like very much strict about that. But it didn't make a difference for me because I spoke it at home. But some families maybe didn't.
My family were from Tenby, but no one spoke Welsh really.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think a lot in South Wales, and especially the closer to the English border you get, there's just more English naturally. But they're really trying to like preserve it and like oomph it and get more speakers. I think they want 1 million speakers by 2025. Is it 2050, I think? Yeah, 2050.
2025, I was going to say, that's like really close.
I think we're on like 850K or something already. So
really?
it's not far to go, but... Yeah, well, they're really trying to like make more of it happen, which I'm trying to help.
Well, I can see that. We'll get to that bit. But so how did Baby Mairead go on to become, you know, a presenter? Especially, I know you're doing Welsh presenting, but from this tiny little town, have you always wanted to be like to break from the town? It's kind of like a stereotype of like, you know, the American stereotype films are like small town girl. Went to break to the big city.
Literally, that was me. I used to listen to like Taylor Swift songs and be like, that's going to be me one day. Honestly, I've always wanted to leave that place because I hated it growing up, not going to lie. I like going back there to visit my family and friends, but it's not for me at all. And I was always an attention seeker.
Like, I can share that.
Yeah, like from a a young age, I was like putting on shows for my family, pretending I was presenting shows.
Not singing, but presenting.
I used to sing too. I used to sing in competitions as well when I was little.
No, but you know, like you put on the little, like the pop star shows. Did you ever do that?
Them and the dance routines with the cousins, you know, all of it.
Love those.
All of it. But I just loved like the idea of being on TV. I remember I used to tell my family I was going to be a weather girl. I mean, that's not exactly what I've done, but I would like point to the wall and be like, it's going to be rainy here, sunny here. Like since I was little, and there's a weird way of getting into Welsh TV in that, I don't know if it's the same in England, but they send kind of producers round schools to like find people who might want to go on like kids TV shows and stuff, like little competition shows and things like that we grew up with.
Where I'm from, that did not happen.
I didn't know if it happened in England because but that's probably you have to apply through websites and that kind of thing. You get headhunted.
So many in the UK, I guess. And I do remember the only time it ever happened, it didn't happen to my school, unfortunately, was when they were looking for the right cast member of Harry Potter. They went around all the London schools because they couldn't find, no one had auditioned who was the right part. Mm-hmm. And I remember going like, I hate my school because no one's talented here. So that's why we're not being picked.
That's so, it's similar to that. They used to do that to cast the people for shows, not for acting roles, but mainly for just like fun, like game shows and things like that. So that's how I got into my first like acting-ish sort of taking part in like a reality fun show when I was younger. But that was when I was 11. I actually had my first TV appearance when I was 5, singing on TV.
And was that for being scouted in your village?
The singing wasn't. That was because of a competition, a singing competition called an Eisteddfod.
Right?
Eisteddfod.
Eisteddfod. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, it's a lengthy word. But it's like a cultural festival and amazing. It's really big in Wales. There's loads of them. It's huge, like a big festival. It's like arts, culture. You sing, dance, recite. It's like a big deal. And I got entered into that through my school, just singing a solo. I was 5, had a wonky fringe and everything, like looked a mess. But I ended up winning that heat and going up to the next heat, which was like a wider area of Wales. And then I went to the national heat.
Like,
and that's like live on TV in front of like a big audience. And I won that one somehow. I won the whole thing. The whole thing, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And it was just like by falling into it as a little kid. I guess I was kind of cute, but I had like the wonky fringe. One pigtail was up here, one pigtail was down here. My skirt was back to front and my socks were inside out. But that was my dad. And my dad dressed me, which kind of explains
why. Oh my God, you're a real country bumpkin. I love that.
Literally, yeah.
You're like a little Charlotte Church.
That's what I used to get described like all the time when I was little. I always used to get that one.
You know what? That was like the one thing. My grandparents were obsessed with Charlotte Church. They thought she was the most amazing woman in the world.
Honestly, what is it about old people in Wales and Charlotte Church? They love her so much.
They weren't even the ones who lived in Wales.
Really?
They just literally felt that she was just like the most perfect woman. And if I ended up like Charlotte Church, I would be the perfect grandchild.
She's like an angel to a lot of people.
She is an angel.
But now she's just like loose and I love that. When she was younger, I used to get compared to it all the time.
Oh, I love that. So was that like the first like glimpse you had into where you could be?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was obviously a really big moment at 5. Most people don't probably have many memories at 5.
Yeah.
So how did you, I guess, break out of your Welsh town? Was that going through university?
Yeah, it was uni. Because up until then, I'd done a few little bits on TV here and then. I'd had an experience of going down to Cardiff from the north and having, you know, taxis paid for, hotels paid for, and, you know,
it's a good life.
Being on a studio. It was fun. I was like 11, 12 doing this, quite a lot of different bits. I did a makeover show with Alex Jones. There's the one show now
where
she was presenting it. I had a little taste of working with people. But then when I was like, I'm going to go uni, I'm going to do like journalism. I didn't know what area of journalism, would it be TV, radio, writing, but I just knew it was the kind of area I liked. And that was my chance to get out of my little town. Went there and I just kind of went full steam ahead. As soon as I went to uni, I had like 3 jobs and I was also freelancing for places and it, like dipping out, emailing every person I could, going on Twitter and like finding every editor for every publication, every commissioner, anyone I could find. Mm. I was just going LinkedIn, Twitter, age 19, just really going in there and finding all the right contacts and just
begging
them. You
were breaking exclusives at the time, right, at university. Yeah.
It was so funny. Like I went into the tab. I don't know if you heard of the tab, but the student of journalism, right? So I was the editor for my one at Cardiff.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was the editor since the end of my first year until I graduated. I ran it. And I was always, I was getting really juicy exclusives that made it to national news all the time that they were like, crazy. They were mainly to do with sexism and racism at the university,
really?
Right? From students. But it was big stories. And they blew up when I put them out on the tab, but then they were actually picked up by other news sources as well. Mm. Some stories I wrote even made it, like, you know, into the Sun, Mail, Mirror at the time. And, you know, being 19, 20, that was kind of, it was kind of sick at the time. Well, I was like, well, this is
deal.
Good.
It's not to say, it's a really big deal.
It was fun. I was watching it like, oh, maybe I could actually do this as a job. Mm. And it helped, because it helped me get a little bit of work experience here and there off the back of it, and then led to my first full-time job at Fabulous. So mm-hmm. I just went kind of straight from uni into that.
Oh my God, I love that. So when you were at Fabulous, what was your job for anyone who doesn't know?
So that was digital writing, and I was just doing sort of celebrity interviews, writing about fashion, beauty, a bit of lifestyle stuff, real life stories, a lot of those, just crazy stories that, you know, it could be anything. Just like, I'm trying to think of an example of the weird stuff. Like, literally, my boobs are so big, I can't find a bra. I have to get them, I have to get them specially made. Or it could be, you know,
Those are the real ones on, like, the Daily Break, those kind of stuff.
Yes, I did them.
I married a serial killer and didn't know.
Yes, exactly. Those kind of bits, as well as the other things, mind. But those were quite funny, because I had to do some interviews, and, like, it was just crazy stuff.
You know, that really reminds me of, you know, in Afterlife, when they go to, like, the national newspaper and it's like, I've grown the biggest gherkin.
No, I've not watched it.
Oh my God, Ricky Gervais.
Yeah, I need to watch it. I feel like everyone keeps, like, recommending this to me.
No, it is really good. It really will remind you of that job, to be honest. But so that's really interesting, obviously, that obviously you've been in celebrity culture for a long time, predominantly most of your career.
Yes.
How have you found working with celebrities?
I enjoy it. I think it's fun. And I think the, like, excitement wears off quite quickly, but then everyone around you gets really gassed for it. It's like, who's the most famous person you've met? Oh, who's the most famous person you've interviewed? Oh, have you met this person? Have you met that person? I'm like, yes, I have. Like, I've worked at a lot of places. But it's not really that exciting when you get to it. They're just people, right?
Yeah.
I feel like people get really gassed up about meeting certain people. And, like, you probably get this a lot, but you become kind of numb to it until you meet, like, a superstar, and then you're like,
I think Kris Jenner, I might die.
Yeah.
Is anyone in particular, if you met them, you would literally faint?
Mine would be Taylor Swift, probably. I'm so basic, aren't I? Maybe that's Lady Gaga, Rihanna, like that level.
You love the pop stars.
The pop girlies.
Yeah. You know, really interesting fact. I actually have met Drake and once had a drink with him, with a group of people.
Really?
With a group of people, yeah.
That's
it's like my one claim to fame, yeah.
That is very cool.
No, it was really cool. I really enjoyed that. That was one where I thought, oh, that's
a good one there. I was like, thanks that for later.
I know. And I hugged him. I was like, do I sniff him? I don't know.
Sniff him?
Joking. I didn't sniff him. But it was funny because I honestly felt a bit frozen.
Yeah.
Because it's Drake, and this was like many years ago. It's like 2019. No, 2019 is when I managed Demi. So really long time ago. And
that's sick.
It was a bit of a shocker.
I feel like it's that level of fame that I maybe might get starstruck by. But, like, in terms of British celebrities, I feel like I see everyone out and about quite a lot of parties. I know quite some, like, a lot of people.
I feel like everyone knows you now. You're at that point, aren't you?
I wish everyone knew me now. My life would be a lot easier if they did.
Why do you not think so? I feel like everyone, when we talk about it, like, it may be like back of house, you know, internally everyone knows who you are. You know, the agencies and the different, because you are, you always have this dual role where you have to be in touch with, you know, I guess the celebrities and the influencers, and, like, can kind of have your ear to the ground, but also you need to know who their agents are and be friends with them. So you actually have to do both sides, which most people don't realize, I think.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people think, you know, reporters just know everyone. It's just completely 100%. Different. Whereas, you know, it is a lot of schmoozing as well, because there's so many.
I just like getting to know people as well. But I feel like, because I've worked, I say, like, journalism, I also know, like, PR companies, management, just through, like, friends and knowing people. But I've also worked in TV production, so I know people there. And also through my presenting, I know a couple of people. So I feel like it all just kind of expands and everyone knows everyone. So
they do. You
just meet someone, you're like, oh, I'm friends with this person that you know. I'm like, of course you know them. Yeah. It happens all the time. Like, literally every day this happens.
Well, you've now got a different experience on it because you now are managed.
Yeah.
So, which is completely different to how when you started as a freelancer, which I'll come back to in a second. But how have you found it almost being like the shoe is now on the other foot? So you started as, you know, someone who was interviewing, you know, for magazines. And now you have a manager and people want to interview you, present company included.
I've been interviewed for a magazine as well in Wales a couple of times. So it's really weird when they're asking me, like, questions about me. I feel like, why? I'm not interesting.
You are interesting. Your career is obviously something that I think a lot of, especially budding presenters and probably small towners, let's say, Huntsville towners, I don't know what to say. locals, you know, would really look up to, because I think a lot of people do struggle to kind of break free. Not everyone is from the big city, or I don't know why I'm saying big city. Like, listen,
Big city life.
I've been watching Sex and the City like every day. For some reason, I just feel like I'm there now. So how have you found that other side? Do you feel like every single one of these experiences is contributing to having a bigger understanding of wherever you may end up in the next 10 years?
100%. I feel like I know how the industry works from every corner now, which is good, because it means I don't get screwed over.
Yeah.
Because when it comes to, like, I don't know, like getting approached to do work, and when it comes to, do you want to work on this show? Do you want to come present like this event? I know exactly how much money I want. I know exactly how I want the contracts to go, the negotiations, like just dealing with people and understanding the ins and outs of how a TV set is run. Like, this stuff is really helpful, and it's like knowledge that no, like not your standard presenter who's only ever done that might not know. So I feel like it's helpful, and it's really easy to navigate stuff and kind of have a clear picture of how it works, if you get what I mean, without me chatting too much shit. But no, it's good. It's useful. I do find it odd, mind, when I'm on like a TV set presenting something and there's like a runner, like, do you want a drink? Do you want some food? I'm like,
really? I think I'd be in my element.
I'm just like, I'll get it myself. Do you want a cup of tea? Like,
no, I would be in my element. I just feel like that's the life for me.
I do like it, mind. I just feel really guilty. I'm like,
oh no, but if they don't have anything to run for, then what are they meant to do?
Yeah, that's what they're being paid for. That's what they're being paid for, to be fair.
Is the Welsh TV market and the English TV market completely different?
Yeah, 100%.
What do you think is the biggest difference?
The Welsh one is just a lot smaller. Not in terms of like its production value and its budget, because it is like super, like,
it's high end. Your show is really
my show's got like 8 camera setups. Like, it's and a jib at the top. Like, it's wild. But in terms of like how many people are in it and how many opportunities there are, it's a lot smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side, it is easier to get into than it is English, because there's so much competition to get into English TV. And as you know, like breaking like a talent into something like ITV is really hard. If they haven't been on a reality show first, if they've never been exposed to that audience, it's quite hard to get someone in the door.
But it is now harder, even if you're reality TV, because, you know, the presenting world is completely different in terms of, they really want people who've been coming up the ranks in presenting.
Yeah.
So it is just difficult, I think, overall. I think having a following probably does help.
Yeah.
But I think your face has been out there so much now. But is it similar to how, obviously, in British TV, you know, channels kind of have their go-to talent? Mm-hmm. Is it that the same in Wales?
It is, yeah. I would say so. But the thing is, you have, like, I know a lot of the people, like the majority of the, like, the faces of the network I work for, S4C, like the majority of the people on it, I know them all, or like I've at least met them a couple of times and we're kind of, you know, friendly. So I feel like it is close knit and there are faces, but you can break in. It's quite, I wouldn't say easy, but it's easier to get your foot in though. If you are talented and if you're making content and putting yourself out there, they will notice you, because speaking the language is gold dust.
Yeah.
Like, if you are clearly good at what you do and you can also speak Welsh, they will give you a shot. They'll trial you out with a couple different bits, smaller stuff, vox pops. And then if you do well from that, they'll take interest. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's not really as straightforward as that when it comes to English TV. A lot of people are incredibly talented and they never break through.
Yeah.
But you do get a lot more opportunity and they give you a lot of time. And they nurture
and they
you a
develop
lot
you, yeah.
Exactly.
It's kind of like talent management in a way, but via a network, because also you're representing them. So is it S4C?
S4C, yeah.
I always used to think it's Stand Up For Cancer, because the logo looks quite similar. It does.
What it is basically,
because
like,
I thought that's what you were doing at first when I first saw it. And I was like, this is amazing. But it really, no, it is. Tell me I'm wrong. The logo is similar.
I get what you mean.
But I saw they've now got a Love Island, Luca Bish, who has now got, a show on.
Yeah, he did a cameo on a show that was on S4C. Yeah, so he was him, Gemma Collins. There was a bunch of people.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, it was Gemma Collins. And then there was like Talia Storm, Blue Hydrangea. There was a bunch of stars that kind of came to do a show on S4C. So on the same network I work for.
Yeah, because I've seen them really pop up since, I guess maybe because I follow you, but they're doing so many other things. So it's really nice to see a bit more of an independent Welsh production company kind of come through the ranks. Mm. So to discuss, you are a presenter for your own show.
Yes.
I'm going to attempt to say it for me. T-Show Fork.
Yeah. T-Show Fork.
T-Show Fork.
T-Show Fork.
It sounds Italian when you say it.
See? T-Show Fork is a question. T-Show Fork?
Do you want a fork?
Yeah. Do you want a fork? I do.
Which is an analogy for you know what. So your show, T-Show Fork, for anyone who does not know, is essentially a table and two people pop up and they're like on some sort of date. Mm-hmm. And you are the host and you get them to play games.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're food related. But when I say they, we're going to have to try and, we're going to have to insert on YouTube the picture.
Because like, this is like the wild,
it is a wild concept, like really wild.
Mae hwn yn braidd y fudur, guys. Braidd yn fudur, lot o regi, sexual content.
It's obviously a dating show, blind date, and Tisha Fark is one of four playing words because it's food themed. It's like having a dinner date, but just your heads are on show, so you can't see what the bodies are like.
Heads on a
plate. You know, it's meant to have that, you know, element of mystery. Because what if they're like really muscly? What if they're really like slim and you're like big guys? Or, you know, it's all just about the mystery. And we had one girl on it who is an OnlyFans creator, and she came on her date like in just like a tiny little like bit of lingerie. And she went did the whole date essentially like nude. And then when the big reveal happens at the end, if they want to see each other again,
yeah,
that's when they see it and there's the big shock. But yeah, it's all just fun, silly little games, all kind of food related. And they ask questions. They ask some like raunchy things. They have to get a bit messy sometimes. But yeah, I just egg it on basically.
How did that come about? What was the original development? Who had the first ideas? Did they bring it to you? For anyone who is in, you know, be interested in being a presenter and how you get your own show.
So yeah, it was a whole long process actually. So it's for Hansh, which is like the young people's vertical on S4C, kind of similar to Channel 4.0 on Channel 4.
Ah,
it's
yes.
the Welsh version of that basically. So I've been doing bits for them for a while, like I said, like Vox Pops and little comedy bits here and there. And then out of the blue, I get an email from a production company called Avanti. And they do a lot of big English shows as well. But like the development.
Yeah, I know them actually. Yeah? I was just literally thinking, I know them.
Yeah, yeah. They've done quite a few big shows. They're really good. Like they do Songs of Praise, lit.
I don't think I know them from that one. But
I don't tend to watch it, but like it's a good Songs credential to have. But they do a bunch of others. I just can't remember them off the top of my head. But their head of development emailed me and she was like, hey, I was just wondering if you're still doing presenting bits. We have a show we'd like to pitch to you if you're free for a call. And I was like, oh, I remember going to my boyfriend, like, guess what? I just got an email. And then I just like, yeah, I can call you now. I called them. I had a Zoom actually. And they just told me we have a dating show, really tongue in cheek, a bit dirty. Think sort of Naked Attraction, dinner date vibes with like a really, really dirty twist to it. A lot of humor, a lot of comedy. Would you be keen? And I was like, absolutely.
It sounds like you in like one description, yeah, doesn't it?
I was like, this sounds like me all over. This is great. And they were just like, yeah, we've been speaking to the network about it. They want to commission it. They love the idea. And they've had you in mind and so have we for a while, but we just need to do some screen tests. And I was like, great. So I went down to Cardiff, did some screen tests. I had to do like a fake version of the show. It's so funny. I want to show you the video. But it was just in one of their rooms in the office, like a desk. And they got two random actors in to play a gay couple, right? And I had to just do dating games with them and they were really raunchy in the screen test stage. It was like they put Nutella on an aubergine and the guys had to suck it off and stuff. Like it was really dirty. We had to like measure their gag reflexes using a cucumber. Like it was really dirty.
Oh my God.
It's been toned down a lot.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've not seen that.
Yeah, that was the screen test.
The screen test was dirtier than the actual production.
Yeah. And these two guys did not know what they were in for, right? They'd just been like looped, like roped into doing this. And only a week later, I found out neither of them were gay. They were both straight. And they just had to pretend for the sake
and
of this.
And they made them do a gag reflex test.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was just like, oh, do you like this in a guy? Do you like this in a guy? No, I was like just doing what I was meant to do for the screen test.
And they're not gay.
No, they were just they were just available on the day. And they were actors. And they didn't know. I didn't know they were actors. I knew. I didn't thought they were like actually, you know, gay.
Sorry, but can you just imagine? You would literally go to your agent. I am never working for this company again. How dare you?
They were friends of the production company. Both of them was like the producer of the show. They were both friends of his, but they didn't know each other. But they were just roped in and were like, okay, just roll with it. That's all they were told.
Oh my God.
And they were like, just roll with whatever she asks you. And they were like, okay.
It's really shocked me to my core a little bit. I love that though.
I've gone off on such a tangent. But anyway, got the job.
Well, you know what? Well, the fact is, did they do the tasks?
Yeah, they did.
Well, then, yeah, there you go. You should have had the job.
Honestly, it was really funny. But it was so scary doing this. I'd never actually like presented a show before. And I had to do all these links to camera, you know, I had to do the whole hello and welcome to like all the cringe stuff.
I think you're good at it though, in terms of what I've seen.
Now I like doing it. I don't care. I can switch into the mode like that and just do it. But back then, like something about recording links when everyone's watching you just makes me like cringe, or at least it used to. But I mean, I got it, found out like a week later. It was very exciting.
For those who don't know, actually is a completely Welsh speaking show, which also makes it super unique if you didn't guess by T-Show Fork.
Yeah,
the name.
Yeah.
I was saying to you earlier that you guys go in and out of Welsh because there are certain phrases that just doesn't translate in Welsh in the funny manner that you would know it in English.
Yeah, it's just a case of like pop culture references and just, you know, memes, basically like jokes and quotes you see on the internet, like those kind of things. They wouldn't translate the same. And sometimes it's like phrases you want to say, it's just funny and it's more natural to say it in English. If you translated it, the joke wouldn't land because the joke was never written in Welsh.
Yeah.
It's those kind of things.
It's a really fun concept. It's a really bright set. You look beautiful throughout it and you've got such high energy. And he's actually gone on to it. You're up for an award, I believe.
Yes. So we won one a couple of months ago and that was wild. Didn't expect to.
What award did you win?
It was like best digital series or something of the sort.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was up against some insane entries. I was like, you know, up against the Sidemen, Jamila Jamil.
No way, that is amazing.
Yeah, we beat them. I think I was up against them locked in as well. Yeah. But yeah,
I'm very proud of you as a friend.
Thank you. it was sick. I didn't expect to win. I actually went f*** off when I was walking onto the stage, which probably wasn't the best thing for me to say, but I was walking on like, really? Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Actually, how the hell would we win? Because it was literally public voting and people like the Sidemen shared it on their stories. I'm like, you know how many followers they have? Like, they obviously voted, but I guess Wales voted more. It was wild.
It was Wales versus the Sidemen.
Yeah, quite literally. It was crazy. I don't know how.
Welsh people are very patriotic.
Yeah.
Well, you did have to have a little stop at one point. You know, I know you're open to talking about it, but you had scoliosis surgery. Mm-hmm. So that was a really big part of, you know, your childhood and growing up is, you know, scoliosis is this curvature of the spine.
Yeah.
So at what point did you have to have surgery or at what point did you make the decision to have surgery?
I was diagnosed when I was 11, but I had to wait 10 years on the NHS list to get the operation and it kept being cancelled and moved. So it was going to impact my GCSEs. So I sat all of them early because I thought it was going to come across when I was meant to be doing them.
Yeah.
And then it just got cancelled like the day before. And that kept happening for years after, like it was ridiculous, like 4 or 5 years. And the final date they landed on was actually the day of my 21st birthday. And it was in the middle of my second and my third year of uni when I was meant to be doing loads of internships and like loading myself up to do loads of work because that's the only way I could get those internships. And it was like, right, yeah, you got this on your birthday, smack bang in the middle of the summer holidays. So I had to do it. It was fine. All went good. You know, recovery was awful, but
there was a lot of press around it, wasn't there?
Well, I wrote a lot about it. Like as soon as I started writing more for Fabulous and like bigger publications, I was like, yeah, let's do some articles because it's the same condition that Princess Eugenie has. And I remember on her wedding day, she showed her scar off in her dress. And there was like people talking about, oh, how amazing. And I was like, well, I've got a scar too. Let's talk about it. Like, you know, I like talking about these kind of things. I mean, it's an invisible disability at the end of the day. I have that. And I was also born without a hip as well. So I went through like the first 20 years of my life having surgery on my hip, having one literally built out of bone grafts, having pins, screws, because I've got, you know, the metal rods in my spine.
Yeah.
But I've also got like loads of stuff going on in my legs. So I've gone back and forth with having loads of disabilities and that can make things hard when it comes to standing up for a long time when I'm presenting. If I'm like, I was reporting on a red carpet, stood there for like 3 hours in the cold, it hurts.
How do you mentally get through that when you're in pain? Because I think it obviously is, like you said, it's an invisible disability and it's obviously debilitating when you're in pain. For anyone who maybe is going through something similar and, you know, this is the line of work they want to go through, you know, what is your sort of process of being able to not have to turn it down, but also not affect your own health, you know, and your own pain threshold to kind of get through it? Have they allowed you, you know, certain rest breaks or is it physically impossible? Like red carpets are hectic.
Lots of wine. No, I'm joking.
I don't think she's joking.
No, that does help sometimes.
Yeah.
But no, I just have to battle on with it because unfortunately there's just not a lot of stuff in place to help with that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, and I also feel like such a diva sometimes when someone's like, oh, you know, that's a, it's a 15-minute walk or something. I'm like, I need to get an Uber. I have to get a taxi. I can't walk that, especially not in like heels or something. But like, I don't know. I've just learned to live with it now. Mm-hmm. And I just push through the pain as much as I can. Like when I am presenting my show, the days are like 15-hour days of filming and I'm standing up for all of it. And sometimes, you know, when we have to change something with the cameras or there's like, you know, something being moved on and offset, I just sit down on the floor for like 5 minutes. I'm like, oh, okay, get my spine a break. It's just back to it. I just push through it, to be honest, because I don't want to make excuses, even though I know I can have these like special measures made, but I don't want to. I don't want it to like feel like a part of what I'm doing. I just want to do it regardless of that, if you get what I mean. It's just a more mental thing for me.
How have you found being a freelancer throughout your life? Do you find that it is quite difficult? And it is, especially I guess in this economy now, it must be quite stressful for freelancers with the cost of living.
Oh my gosh.
I feel like I said cost of living so much in the last few days. It is actually, it's stressful.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. I mean, it's why I have a full-time job now to like have like that stable side to my life. But like when I've been like full-time freelance and that's all my work has just been freelance, it is so stressful. It's the not having a pension, not having holiday pay, like it's not having that security that you're going to have work next month. It's horrible. Mm. I just message everyone I knew, put as many call outs as I could on Twitter, you know, just actively go looking for work because it's not always going to come to you. You can't just sit there expecting work to fall into your lap. I will message commissioners and stuff and be like, have you got any new shows with me in mind? Mm. Or I would be doing social media consulting. I'd go to brands and go, you know, I've looked at your socials. I think I can really help you. Like, would you be keen to have a chat? I would just, I don't know. You have to actively look for it. It is tough.
Mm.
But the thing is with a freelance, you could be like piss poor and be really struggling, or there is that opportunity for you to make a lot of money if you work really, really hard and like beyond like what's expected of a normal person. It is just literally pestering everyone. It's not, and not everyone is equipped to do that. It's not suited to most people.
I think a lot of people have egos as well, which so I think you can't have an ego when you're freelance.
No.
And something I think that I've spoken to some of my freelance friends about is, you know, being paid on time is not a luxury that all freelancers have.
Oh, I've gone mad on this so many times, man. Oh my God. Around Christmas, I think I was owed like nearly 10K. Oof. Just, and as you know, as a sole person, who having done all these jobs, it's like 500 quid here, 700 quid there. It mounts up when people don't pay you.
Yeah.
And it's stressful. People don't seem to realize that we are people with bills.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have rent to pay. That's the hard part. That was probably the biggest struggle is, yeah, you might not have work coming in, but then once you've done that work, some people don't even want to pay you. Honestly, well, at least on time, sometimes it's like, oh, we've got a 90-day pay policy. Like, do you you're going to pay me this week? I'm not waiting 3 months to be paid for something that I've already done.
Yeah, but that's bigger companies, isn't it?
Oh, no, it was like, for me, in my case, it was small people trying to make up excuses to not pay me on time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because I do know, obviously, that some of the bigger corporations or the conglomerates, they do have like 60 to 90 days because they have so many hoops to run through to go through their accounts process.
Mm-hmm.
With things like that, are you a bit more accepting if it is like that? Or is it still a case of you've done the work, you expect to be paid in your own time frame?
I will push back every time. And it's worked. Like when people say, like, my management has been told by a campaign I did, we've always done 60. This is how it's always been. I was like, well, I worked for them freelance before I was with my management and they paid me in 2 weeks. So
I guess if you've got back.
I will always try.
Yeah.
But I guess you just take it. It depends what kind of financial position you're in, I guess. Because if you're desperate for the money, you will do everything you can to get it as fast as possible.
Yeah, but I think there's always that it's really hard to be freelance anyway. Mm-hmm. And like you said, it isn't for everyone. And then there's the added thing of you have this expectation of doing the workload of what they expect, depending what field you're in, right? Mm. And there's just always a very short time frame to get it done.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're not, and then the least they could do is pay you on time, I guess.
Yeah. And then when it's time to pay, tumbleweed, crickets.
No emails.
No, nothing. Oh, that's weird. You're very silent now. Considering last week you were sending me 6 emails a day asking, where is this? It's been due an hour ago. You know, it's that stresses me out when people expect a lot from you very quickly and then they're very slow on the other end. But it's a part of the industry, isn't it?
Marit, if there was one part of your life that you could manage differently, what do you think that would be?
I think it'd just be like better time management of like...
Preach.
Yeah, like a better time management, because my time management is awful in general. Like ADHD again, kicking in. It's just a part and parcel of being one of those neurodiverse people, I guess. But yeah, I do like to cram quite a lot in for like a short period of time, like maybe 2 weeks of being really overbooked, and then I just crash for a whole week. Mm. So I think just managing myself better, not spreading myself thin and then doing nothing, it would be more like consistently keeping it equal across all the weeks. That would be probably what I would change. I wish I could.
Yeah, I think it's part of your ADHD though, isn't it? Because it is very much like burnout is such a big thing, especially, you know, and I also know from speaking to Alex Partridge on my last podcast, who was talking about ADHD, you know, you have these real highs and lows in the, you know, you have this great idea and you get obsessive and then you have this big dip. Do you have something similar?
Yeah, all the time. Like this is literally how I work. That's how I work. But it's how I get so much done too. So I'm grateful for it, as well as it being like a massive burden. It is probably why I'm like doing so much and I do not stop when I'm on that high. So I get a lot done. So I guess it's annoying, but I do like some parts of it, but I would rather be one of those people that could just keep it consistent at all times.
Everyone finds it hard though.
Definitely.
Especially if you're in freelance. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Thank you so much for watching this episode of Managed. If you loved watching, please make sure you're following us so you can receive updates on our next episode. I'll see you next week.